If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder.
Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. My name is Andrew Main. Joining me, as usual, Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen.
And that's it, because there's so much weird out there, we couldn't fit Brian in there. We're like, Brian?
No.
Can't catch you in. Sorry.
Yeah, Brian.
Sitting there at home, wishing he could be part of this conversation, but we're like, no, Brian. No room for you.
He's been swallowed up by the Naka monster, you know, which is a very curious creature, which is a combined amalgamation of stand-up comics and, you know, various bands that had a hit song 14 years ago and magicians. They all come together and just hawk their wares.
Is what he would like you to believe. But in fact, he's sitting home crying to himself.
Of course. We're not yes. Him.
So, Justin, so looking for something to talk about this week, something science related or something that was kind of big space sciencey, and I really couldn't find anything, really not much going on.
I mean, it's almost as if when there is no news to be talked about, we can rely on something to fall from the sky, you know, just, you know, God will provide, as the proverb goes. Just to completely appear out of nowhere and fall into our laps.
I'm not following.
Well, you know, I'm trying to lead you to a story here. We're a peek behind the curtain here. I'm trying to just lead you down the path to maybe talk about the story where something just from beyond the clouds just sort of appeared as a vision.
Oh, you mean the whole dark matter thing, the detector on the International Space Station, the press conference they had where they actually didn't reveal anything and said stuff would be forthcoming. Yeah, that was a bit of a disappointment. Yeah, nothing space related.
No,
nothing I can think of.
No. I mean, let's say you were driving down the road of life and all of a sudden over your steering wheel, you saw just a glorious flash of a gigantic news story as you were driving to work.
Oh, you mean the Russian explosion of techno music?
Well, I mean, I can't say that that's uninvolved in this story, as it was indeed the soundtrack to oh so many of the videos that covered it.
So, you know, in what played out like many a low-budget sci-fi movie that's been coming out of Russia lately, and you know, you've all know about the Russian meteor, and my reaction was I tried to text Justin, get hold of him. And then I got hold of Brian, and so I talked to Brian, and I, you know, Brian's first reaction, it's gotta be fake. I'm like, Brian, there's a lot of videos, and he's like, we could do this, we could fake this. I'm like, Brian, it's on Reuters. Not to say that because it's Reuters, I'm like, I'm pretty sure this is real. And then yeah. He watched the videos, and he's like, yeah, this has gotta be real.
It looked beyond fake. You know, when you first see those videos, it looks so fantastical that. I don't think that you could be blamed if you only saw one or two to think that it was faked.
Oh, for sure. Oh, absolutely. I think that it's given how we've seen things now where massively coordinated events, multiple videos uploaded, it certainly would be likely. And for me, the clinch is I'm explaining like to him, like Reuters says they've talked to people.
Yes.
You know, so that I'm kind of inclined now at this point to accept this is real because it's an actual major, it's not, you know, we're seeing reports on the internet, but like could totally be fake. But when you hear, you know, it's the first person journalism takes place, I'm willing to go, all right, probably. And I've seen fireballs before, and I've seen like outside of meteor showers, and it is kind of an interesting sort of, you're like, wow, did anybody else see that kind of thing? But in any event, it's a pretty big story. Now, what's funny is it turns out that somebody pointed out to us on Twitter that I think about 2 weeks ago, Justin, we actually talked about meteors and meteor impacts. And
yeah.
I think we got pretty close to it. I'd like to play that audio back if I can.
Sure. Absolutely. All right. So, so here we go. What you're about to hear is not us live, but rather the recording of us discussing this topic a couple weeks ago on the podcast. It was actually just me and Andrew also on that particular podcast. And here we go. We're playing that audio now.
I think that's a good point. But you said we had some questions, Justin.
We have some questions about what a meteor impact would be like.
Who is this from?
This is from Ivan in Magnitogorsk, Russia.
All right. Well, Ivan, what you've got to understand is meteors are not real. Meteors are a fictitious thing. They're invented by the space laser lobbyists to frighten you and to make you fund pointless telescopes and lasers to protect you from this. Should you ever be in an experience where somebody says there's such a thing as a meteor and you can see this, if you're in your classroom, go press your face right up against the glass and stare as hard as you can at the empty sky, because there will be nothing there and you can just turn around and laugh at your friends.
You know, it's really important to point out here exactly what a complete circus that science has been made a mockery of on this meteor issue. All right. Just because it's in a couple movies, just because all of a sudden people are hip to talk about it, doesn't mean it's science fact, or else Godzilla would have ruined Tokyo so many times by now.
So, Ivan, just press your little face up against that glass, stare. Get all your friends there to look, because it ain't real. And then laugh at them. That's it. All right. Laugh at science. Laugh at all these lies being perpetrated at you. And there you go. It's all you have to do. So next question.
And here we are. We're back live here now in the podcast recording. Man, I'll tell you what. I think we nailed it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was good.
We're just spot on.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
I mean, other than the not existing part.
Yeah. What turns out they exist. You know, so obviously, you know, close, very close, nine tenths of the way, you know, there to nailing it. But no, definitely. I think we really hit on an important truth in that we use the word meteor.
I think we hit it right on the peg, as good as a New York Times journalist covering electric vehicle.
Exactly. We pretty much did the same amount of preparation into that argument as the reviewer for the New York Times did for driving his electric car.
Apparently, electric cars need electricity. Who knew? In all seriousness, this was, you know, we don't need to describe how impressive and amazing and frightening and fascinating of an event that just took place. When they're saying this only happens once every 100 years and we got to watch this thing happen, blow up, so to speak, literally on social media.
Yeah.
And that's not to say you can't have another 100-year event in a couple years, because, you know, the way those things average out, it's sometimes they come together, sometimes they come far apart. But any event, that 5, 6, 7 years ago, I don't think Russian dash cams were as prevalent. This would be something that we may not have any video of if this took place 10 years ago.
Absolutely. And at the end of the day, I think that my favorite element of it was that there was two threads for which insurance scams kind of ran through. Number one, part of it was, and this is something that's culturally different in Russia than in the United States, is that there is a great prevalence of dash cams in private citizens' vehicles. And part of that, as I read on the internet, and who knows exactly how true it is because of liability, of insurance fraud and liability issues, where people are more likely to keep these kind of mini always-on dashboard cams connected to their cars, which provided a lot of the most explosive kind of footage that we saw of this meteor. I mean, I know the first one that I saw was a guy driving down the highway as this huge, big streak sort of comes toward him, you know, overhead. And then, of course, my favorite element involving insurance fraud was something that you brought up, Andrew, which was the window issue.
Yeah, it was the reports that Russians were going around smashing their windows so they would get replaced, which it was freezing cold there too, which is kind of amusing. So I guess maybe they weren't doing this in their homes, but the idea that, you know, to try and collect on whatever benefits could happen because of the meteor is very enterprising.
Now, immediately, as soon as this hit, the big thought was, and what we did talk about on last week's podcast, was the meteor, which would come within, would shoot the gap between Earth and our satellite orbits, which did happen on Friday. And immediately, I don't think that it would be, you know, wrong to have jumped to the conclusion that this had something to do with that. But as we found out, absolutely no correlation, random coincidence, right?
Yeah, that would appear to be. They came from totally different directions, parts of the sky, and it just seems to be it is one of those things where you have to wrap your head around, because you know you can understand the physics of it to say, okay, the Russian meteor came from a different point in space, different orbit, different place than the one we just had the flyby. But here you have, we're talking about this flyby of what's going to be one of the largest, closest flyby we've had in recent history. And wow, and that's in the news. Then all of a sudden we get the largest meteor impact the day before in 100 years. And it just, you go, man, those two events, they just, it's hard to reconcile the fact that, you know, the math says unrelated. And that's the way randomness works, is randomness isn't spaced out in these nice little convenient gaps that you can say, okay, this is unrelated to this. It just happens in these different little things. And now you're getting more attention towards fireballs. Immediately afterwards, there was a fireball over San Francisco. We had one over Florida. And these things happen every day. But now people are paying attention to, oh, what the hell are those?
And also we hear more about it because now what would be maybe something that somebody writes on, if it is recorded at all, maybe it's posted up on the internet and we don't get great footage of it, but it's talked about in a community blog. Now something like that is more likely to be picked up and spread around on bigger sites as it's, you know, a trend, as, you know, there was something huge before. Things that come subsequently are more likely to get attention. Now, here's what I want to ask you, because as Mr. Plinkett teaches us in movies, sometimes you have the idiot protagonist who needs to ask the questions that the audience would ask. And that's what I feel like I am on this podcast. And I ask you, Andrew, because you are the person who can easily explain a lot of these things. How do we not see this coming? Shouldn't there be something that lets us know that the gigantic Russian meteor is about to land in the middle of Ivan's neighborhood?
The answer to that is has a lot to do with size. So this rock, I think we think is like 150 feet across, which sounds pretty big, but it's a thing that was coming at us, one, from the sunward side, which meant that at night it's easier to see things when they reflect sunlight because you can see them against a dark sky. When this is coming at a very, very high velocity towards the Earth in the direction the Earth's, you know, the side, you know, whichever side of the Earth is facing the sun, it's going to be much more difficult to see this thing coming. We have ways of keeping track of, like, the dinosaur killers. We're pretty good. We're pretty sure that we're tracking all the dinosaur killers that are within our solar system and stuff. There could be some stuff on some really wild sort of orbits that we're not aware of yet. And hopefully we would have enough forewarning when those things are coming. But objects that are smaller than that, the ones that are, you know, the ones that you get your Tunguska and your Chvalisk, or however we pronounce that, Russia. Meteors hate Russia, apparently.
Yes.
Those, and Russia's also kind of big. But those objects are harder to track. But we're right now at a time where we have companies like, deep space exploration companies, the ones that want to mine asteroids.
Yes, who are, you know, planetary putting forth resources, the arcade. Right?
What's that?
Is it planetary resources?
Planetary resources. Yeah, that's another one. The deep space is another one. So planetary resources, which is the most prominent one with Peter Diamandis there, they've announced they have a new model for a easy to replicate telescope that they want to put a bunch of these up there to start scanning the skies and to be able to measure these things. We have the capability and technology now. We have this in the hands of other people besides NASA. NASA is great. NASA does a lot of wonderful things. But NASA is one agency, one bureaucracy, and the mandates that they follow are dictated by a bunch of politicians trying to satisfy their constituents, and it takes a long time to get things done, and it becomes ridiculously expensive. But now we have other people saying, well, we could do this or we could do that. And you know, a lot of the funding to do these things may come from the government, but you have a shelf of things in which you could choose from. So I think there's going to be more attention now to it. We can't just say, well, it's a once in a 100-year event, so we're safe for now. It's not the way it works.
No.
It's you don't get a pass now. You can't, like, the next object pops. It's got, like, no, we just got hit. We're not due. We're fine.
Exactly.
It's not like that at all.
Not like the meteor is going to stop in our atmosphere and say, oh, I didn't know. Sorry, guys.
There was a story, and I don't think – I think it was real. I mean, it was a – they found a guy who was traveling. This is like in the 80s, who – he got arrested – at a terminal once, and they looked in his bag and they found a pipe bomb.
Okay.
And he was apprehended, charging him, and he said, listen, said, I had no intention of detonating the pipe bomb. I don't want to die. I was never going to blow up the pipe bomb. I said, why do you have a pipe bomb then? What possibly could be your explanation for having a pipe bomb? And he said, well, I don't want to get blown up by another bomb on a plane. What are the chances there would be two bombs on a plane? So if I bring my bomb... rationality of a crazy person, but this is also the same sort of rationality people use in casinos and stock market traders and other people will use.
Yeah.
That you know, you can't have these two events come together because this one says, no, this doesn't happen. Well, it's a coin toss. Every coin toss is independent from the next one. Once in a 100-year asteroid thing, well, there's a once every 1,000-year asteroid impact. There's a once every 1,000,000-year asteroid impact. There's a once every 1,000,000,000-year asteroid impact. And we don't know how these things are timed together. So it's worthwhile for us to look into paying more attention. This is my lesson that I learned last week.
Yeah.
Space is real.
What? Now, real in a sense that you thought it was less real before you saw the gigantic fireball streaking over Mother Russia?
I think that when we talk about things in the abstract or things that happen in space, you look through a telescope and you look through this little viewfinder and you see stars. And a lot of people haven't had that experience, which is something I highly recommend. Go to your local planetarium or a place that has a bunch of people telescopes and go take a look through there. I think that it's worthwhile. But when we watch things like the Mars Curiosity rover and these other far out things, the problem is it feels a little bit distant. Or we watch people on the International Space Station. We see stuff on television all the time of what fake space, all that. It kind of tends to be like, is this sort of – and also, like, you look at people on the ISS. It's like, all right, it's kind of like a really high-flying airplane. I know that's a stupid analogy.
Sounds like something I would say.
Yeah, but when you sort of step back and you say there is this huge – massive piece of rock 150 feet across just smashed through our atmosphere and exploded, and you got to worry when we start using terms of how powerful it was in relationship to how many Hiroshimas was it equal to.
Yes.
Okay. And I think the latest count is this was like 80 Hiroshimas. Okay, so
that's
80 times the power of the explosive power that got dropped over Hiroshima in World War II exploded, fortunately, higher up, but in the atmosphere over a part of Russia and blew out a ton of windows. 80 nuclear bombs. 80 nuclear bombs went off in our atmosphere.
Now, do we have any sense on where this thing landed? Because obviously we saw it come, you know, to where it blew up in our atmosphere, but we have no sense of where it landed, right?
Well, there will be pieces of it, but it's very what you saw on the video. It's very deceptive. It looks like it's just a few hundred feet up. That is thousands of feet away. Okay. It was a massive, massive object that exploded in the upper atmosphere. So you're watching something that's several miles away. Okay. It's not nowhere near as close as it appears to be when you see it on the video, just because that's the size of it. And so this thing, most of it just exploded, which means that it's, you know, tiny, fine little particles ended up just raining down all over the place, the things that didn't get vaporized. So there are going to be chunks of it, but there's not going to be like a big rock with a baby Jor-El inside of it.
Sure. Now, you want to know what the only thing that I had a greater appreciation for. See, you had a greater appreciation for space being real. I had a greater appreciation for Battlestar Galactica. And let me explain to you why. Because when you watch that episode with the Adama maneuver, when he brings the Battlestar Galactica down into the atmosphere and then launches the Vipers and then FTL's out of there. That looked like that effect. Like, that effect was done so well that when a meteor actually came into our atmosphere and we recorded it in the cold light of day, it made that effect look better. And I was very happy about that.
Well put, sir. That's another thing, too, is that explosions, you get in Hollywood movies, we tend to get the, our movies in general, not just blame Hollywood, you get, when you normally see explosions, we get the big fireballs.
Yeah.
But anybody who's watched combat footage, have seen explosions go off, often it's big clouds of smoke and dust. And what we saw is there was fire, there was flash, but there was just a lot of like smoke from this thing. And that's kind of what made it sort of interesting. It's not just this pure ball of fire, it's smoke, and then there's bright flash as this thing just superheats and ignites. And you look at the video footage of the shadows of the building where you see them, it's just normal daylight, that the bright shadows of the building as they move from this object, which you got to figure this is going over, you know, hundreds of square miles. Just an amazing, you know, you think about the amount of energy that got released there, it's incredible.
Now, we saw the San Francisco fireball and you know, everything else that followed it. But do you think that we are fundamentally going to change the way we think about meteors, or is this just something that was kind of a black swan in how big it was, how well documented it was, that it went over an area where people were recording, you know, a lot compared to, you know, the vast expanse of Earth where people are not, you know, recording dash cameras and random iPhones and whatnot.
I think that we had here a best case scenario example. And what I mean by that, and there are people that their lives were impacted by this, by the exploding glass, and there are people who were injured, but we know of no fatalities.
Yeah.
Which thankfully nobody was killed from this. There may be some people who've got some lacerations and stuff, and I am very sympathetic to what happened there. But it could have been worse. It could have been a lot worse. You know, where the region in which it, you know, the explosion happened, where the shockwave happened, things just were a little bit different, a little bit different size, even just a different orbital pitch or whatever. This thing could, again, this was 80 Hiroshimas. It was, what happened in Hiroshima was devastating because it happened right over the city and the explosion was so powerful it was able to do this. This happened further up. If this happened a little bit further down, you would be looking at collapsed buildings and a much greater tragedy there. And there are parts of this world where they don't have quite the same building codes. Now, most of the world is water. And so, yeah, if this happened over there, be bad. And that would have been a preferable thing would have been if it just happened over water. That would have been the ideal situation because then nobody would be having broken glass in their face.
Not,
but what happened in this
not
situation?
Not many dashboard cameras, though.
No, no. And it would be a thing that it would be a – you know, we would have some seismic information. There would be marine seismic. We'd have some satellite data on it. But it would be this, hey, we think this earthquake thing or this tremor may have been a giant asteroid exploding in our atmosphere, meteor. And that would be kind of an, oh, interesting. But because we had in an area with people and we got video of it, it became very real. It became very real. And we've had scientists telling us this could happen. This could happen. Everybody has been saying, every scientist says, this is a reality. We need funding for this. Now we have this thing happened, and thankfully no loss of life, but a very visual thing to it. I think it does change the way we think about things.
Final question. Pre-YouTube, is this even a story? Or is this a curiosity for science and space fans?
I think that it's not even having to go pre-YouTube. I would even say just 5 years ago. YouTube was 2006, just a few years later.
Yeah.
Without the dash cams, without the mobile phones with the video on it,
yeah.
I'm not sure what we have. We've seen surveillance camera video of meteor bursts before, nowhere near the size of this, of course. And I think that it would not be the same story. It certainly would not be the same story even just a few years ago. I think that's how serendipitous this happened when it did, because the ability is recorded. And it wouldn't, and there is a if you go do a search for, you know, thought of impacts or whatever, you find there's these things happen. Nothing like this scale happens this often, but there have been other things that would, you know, make look like daylight in certain places, whatever, but generally they happen in remote regions. But again, this size of this just has not happened. The size of it over, you know, inhabited area is unprecedented and it certainly would, it would be a story talked about in scientific journals, and there'd be the speculation of, you know,
whether we're under
what
attack,
it could have been or whatever.
Should we arm up now? Is this the first volley?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I totally get the sense that, you know, if we're not in a culture where there is, you know, video recording is this cheap and people do it, because I don't even necessarily think that it's a matter of the super prevalent video recording, but also the idea that we're watching all these experiences through, if not the literal point of view of people, then as close as we're going to get, you know, that we hear, we joke about the music and the Russian techno and everything, like, but that matters, like, in terms of us personally contextualizing what this was, it not only provides a better point of view visually for the big gigantic fireball coming toward us, but also I think is just fundamentally different than watching a very static, silent security camera.
Let me give you an example way to think about it. If we take the world's oldest person, the world's oldest living person right now, who is like, you know, I'm pulling up right now on Google, a Japanese person who is, and it's some of these dates, some of these things, it gets kind of squirrely because sometimes people confuse their birth dates or their parents or whatever, but we'll take the one, number one, which seems to be verified, and they're 115 years old, 304 days. They're almost going to be 300, they're almost going to be 116 years old in a little while if they make it to that. So 115 years old, okay? The last time we had a major impact like this was 1908, all right? So this person
Where was that? Where was the 1908 one? Do we know?
That was Tunguska. That was Tunguska, Siberia.
Okay.
All right. So this person was 11 years old. So they were 11 years old, and this massive, massive meteor exploded over Tunguska, Russia, flattened the trees for hundreds of thousands of acres. Okay. Just trees. Just thousands of trees were flattened. It happened in such a remote region. Only a few people were able to observe it. And word got back to the more populous areas of Russia, but it took years before they're able to send an expedition out to even go look there to verify these stories. And they go out there and they see flattened trees everywhere. They documented, they took a lot of photographs, and you look at Tunguska, and that was our last thing. And that was what happens when something like this happens a bit lower. And it was event. We still were trying to figure out what happened. And there are all sorts of weird stories like, oh, it was an antimatter explosion. Maybe it was a black hole. Maybe it was a comet or whatever. And some people think this may have been a comet, you know, because maybe there weren't as many pieces because a lot of it was just ice. But in any event, it was a thing. We did not know what happened. It was this pervasive mystery about what took place. And whenever you wanted to talk about, you know, it could happen here, you'd say, well, look what happened to Tunguska. And then, you know, it was like, okay, we know that was real, but that's this remote part of Russia, whatever. And now we get this thing that happens now. But the last time this happened, nobody got a look at it for years. As this thing happened, there were people taking video and within minutes uploading it to the internet. And millions of people knew within an hour, and probably by within a 24-hour period, probably a billion people had seen some footage of this taking place.
Yeah.
And all the every space scientist in the world was aware of this, poring over it, looking at the data. And that's an amazing transition. That's what you see in the lifetime of the world's oldest person, going from where it was this mythical sort of thing we think happened, nobody was there to record it, we have to go after the fact years afterwards and take photographs, to now, almost as it's happening, we're dissecting it.
That's amazing. It really is. Andrew, we have a sponsor for this episode, and his name is Sean Hayworth. I want to absolutely give a good fat plug to Mr. Hayworth. He says, ever look at those child beauty pageant shows and think, I could do better? Well, now you can. The child beauty pageant card game, Andrew, card game. That's what you want to do. All right, listen, it's called Child Beauty Pageant Tycoon. It was created by Matthew Fredrickson with art by Len Peralta. That's what you want to do. Let me just go ahead, and I'm going to do what you guys will do right now and just Google Child Beauty Pageant Tycoon. It's on Kickstarter right now. They are at $2,370 of their $26,000 goal with 19 days to go. But let me just let you guys know, you know, there's a lot of talent here. Not only is this, you know, made by Mr. Fredrickson, but the art is done by Len Peralta, who we all know from the Geek a Week trading cards. He is a good friend to really everybody. But, I mean, he's been on FSL Tonight. He's a regular on, you know, so many awesome podcasts. He's an awesome dude, and his art is fantastic. So do me a favor. Head on over to Child Beauty, or sorry, go to Kickstarter and search for Child Beauty Pageant Tycoon, and you're gonna read all about it. But go ahead, throw a few ducats their way, because they only got 19 days to go, and that's a steep hill to climb. And this is Kickstarter, baby. They roll all or nothing over there. This ain't like Indiegogo where you get to keep your winnings if you go three quarters of the way there. Nah, man, it's all scratch unless you make your mark. So go ahead, if you dig it, throw some bucks their way. Spread the word on Child Beauty Pageant Tycoon on Kickstarter by Matthew Fredrickson. And thank you to Sean Hayworth, who is an awesome human being. Him and his wife have been so supportive of not only this podcast, but so many others. They actually brought Andrew, if you remember, when we did a lecture for you, a magic lecture for you in Sacramento. They brought cookies.
I like the cookies. The cookies were good.
Absolutely.
Chocolate chip.
Exactly. Chocolate chip cookies that we hoped were not laced with arsenic. And luckily we're not.
We took our chances. But I think I love one of the things I never would have foreseen about Kickstarter was what this could do for things like games and gaming and creating card games, et cetera. And to create a good card game isn't just having great art like they have. It's doing a good printing. It's doing that. It's creating, you know, establishing a group of people to play this. So I think if you like card gaming and you have an odd sense of humor, I think you should check this out. I just love the idea of Child Beauty Pageant Tycoon.
Of course. You know, I think can we say a creepy industry?
Yeah, I think it's a great way to make light of how creepy this industry is and to say, all right, well, you want to run this creepy industry, this is what you do. Very clever.
Because it's one of those industries that, like, I don't know which is creepier. Those that are participating or those that are fans of it.
Yeah.
It is creepiness on all sides. A real festival of creepiness, which is what makes it such excellent fodder for a card game. So,
whereas my fixation on women's college volleyball has to do with just the mathematics of it.
Absolutely.
The arcs.
Because at contours. The end of the day, let's even look at that. That you could say legitimately, well, I just like to see a certain level of athletic competition. That you know, a major college volleyball is certainly a X amount a level of competition that you could plausibly say you're interested in. I don't know if there's anything that you can say about child beauty pageants.
No. Those kids aren't good at anything.
No. So there we go. Go check it out. It is awesome. And I'll tell you, I agree with you. Like I'm kind of even late to the game of the tabletop industry, you know, the revival of kind of adult, you know, card games and board games. And I always even thought of it on some level as more of an adolescent trend I was young when Magic the Gathering really, really got big. But it's huge, you know, and it's something that to me, I mean, certainly in my circle of friends is kind of only getting bigger, you know?
Yeah, it is.
And they're
fun.
They're really fun.
I think as we progress technologically, it's important to think about what things will stay with this. And I think that 100 years from now, you're going to have some kids coming up with their version of beauty pageant tycoon or cards against humanity or whatever, because there is this other layer of interaction that comes into place. Or not to say that we won't be able to simulate or replicate them in other ways, but there is this, you know, you can play online poker, but there's nothing like sitting down at a poker table with real cards and having them dealt out to you. There's just something about that. And the same thing with these tabletop games, group of people in a room, pizza on the counter, playing this sort of interactivity. I don't think it'll ever go away. And I love science fiction where they, I just watched Star Trek: The Undiscovered Country again, and one of the little touches I loved about it was there's a press con- or not a pre- there's a secret meeting, but there's a table with carafes of water and glasses sitting to the side. This is the 23rd century, but somebody says, you know what? People are still going to need to drink water, right? There's the meeting in the Federation president's office, and the walls are kind of like high tech looking walls, but he's got this these 90s, these 18th century, 17th century Elizabethan furniture there. Yeah. So this feels real to me because it's not like all these other future movies. It's like, ah, we destroyed the past. We just got rid of antiques and stuff. And the only time you'd ever see an antique would be like, oh, look at this quaint 20th century exactly. thing I have.
Like, oh, what a crazy antique phone you have. You
yeah,
know?
Exactly. Yeah, you know. Whereas, you know, why wouldn't they want to have things that were really, really, you know, that would be antiques today, but still functional and useful, like desks and chairs and lamps and these kind of things.
Or why wouldn't these styles still be pervasive? You know, that, that we still have Roman columns and buildings, you know, and it's influenced by this stream of thought that has continued through history.
Yeah. And I understand part of it is in sci-fi, you want to show that it's the future. But if you it was great like they did in Star Trek, like you, everybody knows this is the future. What I think I mentioned this before that I liked in the Fifth Element was that the Ruby Rod was predominantly a radio star.
Yes.
Which I thought that was, yeah, why not? Because there's always going to be activities where you're focused on something else, where you're going to be willing to listen to, you know, some jackanapes like us just barking into your ear. And I don't think that'll ever go away. Oh, speaking of impacts.
Yes.
Our hero, patron saint of weird things, whether he likes it or not, Elon Musk.
I don't know if we want to saddle him with our fandom, but I think he has to tackle it no matter what.
Yeah, he has to. It's part of it. So they did a test, which we talked about, I think, of the Grasshopper system. That's the test bed they're using to build a reusable, rapidly reusable multi-stage rocket. By rapidly reusable, it's not, it parachutes down and you drag it in from the ocean and then you refurbish it. It's, it lands on the launch pad, you refuel it, it takes off again. Amazing, amazing thing. Go to spacex.com. You can check out some videos there, listen to them talk about their goals for that. That is a thing that will more than anything, if this is successful, is the most radical idea in all of space technology since a guy named Goddard said, let's put liquid fuel inside this rocket.
Yeah. That fundamentally changes what we think about space travel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, if this works. So after they showed the latest test where they had this, basically it's the first stage of a Falcon 9, the same sized thing that they're using to launch part of the rocket that goes to the space station now. They had a first stage do a 130-foot hop, went 130 feet up in the air, and then landed back where it took off from. Musk said on Twitter,
let's try to launch it without fuel. They called it the New York Times test, and they tried to launch it without fuel.
Did
it was
work.
Unsuccessful, so they put it on a flatbed truck and took a picture.
Yes. Musk is a very fascinating guy. He's doing a lot of interesting things. Whenever he speaks publicly, he very much speaks from the heart, which, you know, people are sometimes maybe perhaps critical of, but there is something to appreciate about the fact that he's very sincere when he talks, and he tries to be extremely honest about the things that he feels he should be. And then, you know, there's certain things that areas of technology and business plans that he doesn't disclose and people want to know, and for whatever reasons. But in any event, he talked about on Twitter, he after they had that the video up showing that, he said, well, looking forward to the next one, we may cause a crater with this, calling it the Johnny Cash Hover Slam.
Which, sounding like the best dish in Denny's history, you know, is quite some big shoes to fill. Now, do we have any idea what the Johnny Cash Hover Slam might be?
All we know right now is that they've sent this thing up 130 feet. And Musk has said repeatedly in the attempt to try to figure out and solve the technological problem of making a rocket reusable, you have to do a lot of experiments. And you go out there and you do this, you know, right now they're doing it in McGregor, Texas. At a certain point when they're going to go really high up, they'll probably go to White Sands Missile Range. You go there because it's a missile range.
Yes.
And it implies two things. One, missiles, which are rockets, and two, range, which means there's a lot of room for them to fall down. So I think before they do that, they can do certain testing. I think they can go up to like 2,000 feet in McGregor, Texas. this implies they're going to try to go really higher with it. Now, we had Jeff Bezos' company, which is very secretive. Blue Origin did their rocket system. They sent that much, much higher up, but I don't think it's anywhere near the size of what the Falcon 9 stage is. But that went up and it crashed somewhere where they were testing it. But this is going to be fascinating. And Musk is already telling everybody, hey, listen, good chance this will crash. We're going to have some crashes. We're going to make some craters. Just let you know.
Yeah.
There are going to be some craters. Could be. If we're lucky, there won't be craters, but chances are.
We want to prepare you for crater. Because if it's crater, then at least we can say, listen, we told you this was not going to be perfect.
Remember right here?
Yeah.
Johnny Cash Hover Slam? Slam is in not Denny's.
Yeah. That being said, if it's successful, be pretty nice.
Pretty nice. Pretty nice. They'll get data either way. I found a video and I put it up on my Twitter of the one of the guys who is the I think it is Tom Mueller, who is the a VP at let me get the name right. He's the guy that actually was one of the engineers that Tom Mueller of SpaceX. He's one of the co-founders. Actually, it was I think his idea for the Merlin engine, which helped Elon Musk say, "Hey, I think we could have a business there." And there's a cool tour of the McGregor, Texas facility where they test their rockets now. How do you test? I've seen up until this point, I've seen like single engine tests where they're sitting on the side. And this is really cool. What they have there in this video, you'll see a big, huge platform with four legs, big, huge platform with four legs. And then on top of it is the first stage of a Falcon 9 with nine of these engines on it.
Jesus.
Mounted to this thing, bolted like hell to this thing because it's a goddamn rocket. And then they do an ignition on this thing and just huge flames just shoot out from underneath there. The next place I think they're going to be doing some tests is going to be at Vandenberg, where they're going to be working on the Falcon Heavy, which is going to be basically three of those, so 27 engines. But it's really amazing to see this thing. I think they're building actually a bigger test bed at McGregor for that too. But it's just giant structure with a rocket on top that's fastened to it, where you just watch these flames and shoot out there.
You know, I would love to see, and obviously, and we've joked a bunch about the Tesla New York Times thing, but Elon Musk is in a lot of industries, and two that we've discussed right now, and certainly you could say solar panels with Solar City would be another one, where managing expectations and controlling the narrative is very, very, very important, because these are experimental technologies that he wants to see applied on a much broader and wider, swath of our culture. And it's interesting to see somebody in that position in this day and age when news travels so fast, try to do that, to be upright and forthright and honest as he can and will be and should be, but also try to defend the elements that he so much cares about.
There's, you know, the battle that he's trying to deal with is that in the way that the market works, that there are a lot of people out there who have very good ideas or interesting ideas on technology who can get funding. And there are venture funds that say, listen, if only one out of 10 things works, we're willing to fund 10 things to find the one because we'll make our money back, which means nine of those things are going to fail. But the people they give their money to are going to be people who are smart and competent and could be the people who make these things succeed. And Musk has put himself into industries where there have been other people who've had maybe good ideas but have failed, sometimes spectacularly, sometimes just for being just there before market was, and sometimes just not for maybe the engineering side was there, but the marketing side wasn't. Or, you know, one of the biggest problems when you try to develop a new technology and people have this, why don't we have X? Why don't we have X? To get from here to there, you don't know how many little incremental steps are involved. If you have an idea for a new rocket engine, maybe that engine will work great on paper, but the problem is we don't have the technology to make the parts with enough precision to do that, or to do it inexpensively, or to do these. There's all these little things come into play. Or electric cars. You know, why don't we have more electric cars? Well, it comes down to battery.
Yeah.
You know, half the weight in an electric car are the batteries. And even then, the car with the biggest range, I guess, would be probably the Tesla. You know, you still get, well, it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't do what we want it to do. And for a certain audience, it's a great vehicle. And there are these little incremental problems that come into play and why these things don't necessarily work. And so Musk has to deal with the expectations of one group of people who want this stuff to succeed. And then the people are like saying, well, this is where it failed before. Why are you any different? And Musk, I think, has a very good mind when it comes to understanding. You get into an area when you think those engineering problems can be solved with a certain amount of capital and you can deliver a product that will meet those expectations. And that's, you know, been a challenge. I remember, like, you know, Solyndra was a spectacular failure in the solar energy market. And that was predominantly because it wasn't so much that their technology was bad. It was because their business model was bad. This was a company that was going to make solar panels in the United States at a time when the Chinese were pouring tremendous amounts of money to drive the cost of solar panels down to turn them into a commodity, much like what happened to microprocessor chips and memory chips, where and you know, anybody who studied that and said what happened there could see what was going to happen here with solar panels. To try to get into solar panel construction at a time when there are companies funded to drive the price down way below you'll ever be able to sell them at a profit, you're not going to make money. It's just a bad bet. And a lot of things happen. You know, Fisker Karma, which is having trouble. Fisker Karma is another electric car company, and one of the people involved with that was involved with Tesla. And you had, you know, some smart engineers there, and they said, well, we have our idea on how to do this, but it's not as easy as just you just go out there and do it. And I think that, you know, Musk is sort of – I think Musk is different. I think he's a black swan. I think he's a guy that very much understands when you can put something into the market and when you cannot. His business model for Tesla was brilliant. Start off with this high-end roadster that's going to have a very, very narrow market, but he knew every geek in Silicon Valley would want to have one of those.
Yeah.
Based on the success of that, he could then have the technology to go build the Model S.
It's always good to know that the person that the people that you're going to be selling your first wave of cars to are currently in your iPhone, and you can probably, you know, sell out your first run by just making some calls over a long weekend.
Yeah, he knew that the problem with electric cars was that people said, well, let's make the ideal electric car, and they were trying to create the VW of electric cars. But the problem is that it wouldn't go very fast, and it wouldn't go very far, because to make the VW, you know, of the electric car meant you had to keep the cost below a certain price. But that was like, that would be trying to invent, you know, the iPhone in 1995. The technology just wasn't there to make that happen. You could understand the concept of it, but processors weren't fast enough, cellular antennas weren't small enough, display panels didn't work, all these things just weren't quite there yet. But you could create something, you know, something else. You know, he could make something. He said, well, I can make a more expensive car, but it'll go really fast because electric cars can go faster than conventional automobiles. You know, electric dragsters are crazy fast. He said, well, I can make something faster, which there are people who like to spend a lot of money on fast cars with limited range. So why don't I go there first, go to that market? And that was brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. I once spent a very chilly evening at a drag race facility on a Friday night watching an electric dragster that was never able. They were trying to that night break the record for as fast as an electric dragster had gone to that point. And the problem was not that they couldn't get the power, because they could. It was that the car itself, they were breaking the car itself with how fast they were trying to run it.
Yeah, the transmissions just rip apart on those things.
They just tore out. No, it's fascinating. And you know, it's interesting to see that constant tug back and forth of like you said, like, you know, Musk saying, all right, listen, this might be the fundamental change of how we think about rocket technology going to space. You know, we saw today that, you know, I don't know how official the reports are, that to go on Richard Branson's technically going to space, you know, Virgin space ride would cost $200,000. You know, like, we are getting closer to fundamentally understanding where our role is in the greater universe off Earth. You know, if even just in the idea of looking at it, you know, for a price at a closer distance. Yet this particular step could cause a massive crater. And if all we said, if he didn't come out and say, this might blow up, and all we did was have a picture of a huge crater saying Tesla rocket fails, does that fundamentally change how we think of, or not Tesla, sorry, SpaceX. If we just have that big crater and it says SpaceX rocket fails and he's not out in front of it talking about it, do we fundamentally think about SpaceX differently? Do we think of them as an unsafe company?
That's the problem he has to deal with, is it is rocket science. It is a area filled with just explosive examples of things gone wrong. And we've talked about this before, that our early space program, we couldn't get a rocket up. Right after Sputnik, we just kept trying to get a rocket up, and we couldn't get anything in the air until we basically went over to the Army rocket scientists, which were all the former Nazi scientists, and brought them in and basically took a military rocket, repainted it, and said it was now a civilian rocket, and used that to launch, I think it was the Explorer satellite. And that was, because it was just a very problematic thing. The best minds in the world, outside of the ones working for the Army, were working the civilian space industry trying to do this. And the Army could have done it. We could have beat Sputnik up there. We had the rocket. We had the capability to do that. But our government said, we want our first step into space to be a civilian one,
which,
is a very noble kind of goal in many ways. But at the end of the day is when we look back at history, like, well, the Russians beat us there. Well, they did. They absolutely did. And they had an amazing space program, developed some incredible technology. But we kind of put an arm behind our back because we said, well, we really want to pursue this civilian idea. And then when that didn't work out, we just said, well, let's take that Army rocket over here.
Oh, yeah. By the way, we could just throw another coat of paint on it.
Redstone. Yeah, right. We could work with that. But anyhow, it's
spray a new name on it.
Yeah, he's got to, in Musk's case, he's got to say, hey, listen, I said this is happening. This is going to happen. Because, and you don't want to be fear averse. And that's the problem, is you become risk averse. And that's a problem, let's say, NASA has, is NASA knows if they have a spectacular failure, and there have been ones, but every time they have that, everybody second guesses, why should we be doing this and whatever. And there's one reason, you can say certainly that when there's a human cost, that's a very important question. But when, they're more comfortable to let things just overrun their budgets and eventually get canceled than they are to take, develop new riskier technology. And then they do spend a lot of money on developing new high-end technologies and trying to do that. They've gotten better about that. They have conferences now to talk about just far-out ideas, methods of propulsion. They should be very open to doing that. And I think they should consider putting even more funding into that, and the public needs to encourage that. I think there's a lot they can do within what they have. But in any event, Musk is trying to say, hey, listen, I'm calling it now, so don't yell at me when this happens.
Yeah. But at the same time, might work.
Might work. If it works, I've seen cost analysis that would show that if we had a rapidly reusable rocket like he proposes, scaled up to the Falcon Heavy size or the Super Heavy with a reusable system, you have cheaper access to space than even a space elevator would give you. A space elevator still takes time. It still takes energy. And if you want to get something up there within a reasonable amount of time, space elevators are a lot more problematic than people think. Not anybody on this podcast, but I love the idea, but it's one of those things. You just look at all the technical problems there and you say, listen, we have another technology that's better.
Let's not talk about the space elevator without the Mr. Space Elevator here.
Yes. And my point is when you have a very, very good form of technology here that could be less than 10 years away from being the most efficient way to get stuff into space, short of space blimps.
Yeah.
Go for it.
It's amazing.
Yep. Do you want to do one more or picks?
I think we're at our atmosphere here, and I think we have a good long picks thing, segment. So let's go ahead and move on into picks.
All right. I've got a really good one though.
Oh, okay.
Really good topic.
All right. Well, then let's do the topic, man. You're the quarterback here. You call the plays. I back the plays you make.
Montana just passed a law. Do you know what this law is?
No.
So I'd been up for debate for a while in Montana and back and forth on it, and finally got passed 19-2 in the House, and it's now on its way to the Senate. And at first, some people have a little bit of problem with this law when they hear about it and saying, well, why are you doing that? Do you any idea what this is? Any idea?
No. I have no. Can you give me a hint?
It has to do with, I would say, recycling in a sense.
Does it have something to do with corpses?
Yes.
Does it have something to do with using human matter for something we would describe as mundane as opposed to something medical?
Not human.
Not mundane?
Montana's passed a bill allowing meat from roadkill to be consumed.
That was illegal?
Yep.
Man, I'll tell you what. That's the problem with government. Always getting in your kitchen. Telling you what you can and can't eat.
So, if you've been to Montana, Montana's got a lot of animals. And so when they talk about roadkill, they don't necessarily mean possum.
No.
Or the raccoon or the dead cat. They're talking about mountain lion, bighorn sheep, things that get hit by car that are perfectly digestible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or edible.
And, you know, they're big enough animals that, you know, you could certainly cut up elements of that corpse that, you know, would be untouched by the car and probably just damn good eating.
Yeah. So previously it was against the law to eat it, but now they've said, yeah, you know what? You know, let's. So if Senate says okay to it, finally, and I love this quote. From the Senator Levine said, or Representative Levine said, as people know, people hit a lot of animals on roadways, and I mean a ton of them. There's a lot of good meat being wasted out there. I just thought that was a nice to know. Finally. I would think that like PETA's got to be okay with this, right?
Well, I mean, they are strictly vegetarian, but yeah.
These were free range animals.
Certainly, listen. You can say it's organic, free range,
accidental,
you know,
death.
no one was out there trying to kill these animals. You know, they just kind of wander out to their deaths. But yeah, I mean, you got to wonder, like, because I always, and this is something I don't want this to get, you know, political, but like. Things that are illegal have a harder time becoming legal than legal things have a tendency to become illegal. You know, it's harder to go back from that. So you got to wonder, there's a lot of pressure that has to build up before something makes that turn back to legality. You know, what was the lobbying effort for the Roadkill Eaters Association?
I would imagine, if I were to guess, and I only know is that article, I would guess, though, that it probably was that senator or a senator who was a hunter or somebody like that who was used to this and, hey, listen, and knew, like, you know, they had talked to people like, yeah, we know this is a, you know, you run into it and, you know, legally you can't do this. And there are probably cases where people were prevented from doing this and said, this is stupid. If I get elected, you know what? I'm going to try to pass this.
Yes. I wonder if it was part of his campaign. You know, he's out there like, look at all this meat that's being wasted. And if I'm sent to Washington, I guarantee you that will be on your dinner.
So that was the quick one. I got another one we'll do when Brian's on here.
I'll tell you what. I do want to point out that the big Florida python hunt is over.
What was the tally? How many? There got to be thousands out there. How many did we get?
I do believe that the final tally on this was...
Of the thousands of pythons out in the Everglades, how many did we catch?
I'm trying to find
And I love the
one.
Way that you found a way to lose both of your phone, your credit card, and your driver's license at the same time.
Yes, I know.
Brilliant.
I believe we had 68 Burmese pythons.
68,000?
No, 68.
6,800?
No, just 68.
68.
68. And
how many Burmese pythons are there in a litter of pythons?
Probably a lot.
About 68.
Not 68. 30-day hunt, ladies and gentlemen, that was put on by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. People from over 38 states and Canada came on down to the lovely Sunshine State of Florida. 1,600 of them in total paid $25 a head to head on out into the Everglades. Andrew, And we are people who were you know, raised, have great affection and respect for the Everglades, paid for the privilege of wandering out in the Everglades, $25, to catch or kill as many of the pythons that they could. And, of course, there was a $1,000 bounty out for both the biggest the biggest python captured, but for amateurs and professionals. There were two ranks. The longest one that was caught was re-released back into the Everglades.
Delightful. So, I don't think you get your money back, do you?
No, they got their money, but it was released back into the...
The people who paid for to do this.
Yeah. You know, became a bit of a object of criticism, the Florida Python hunt. And there were some reports of people who were, you know, not local to Florida that came down seeking, you know, fame, fortune, and python skins that were, you know, then found themselves in the middle of the very, very treacherous Everglades with no way to get back and had to be rescued. Who knows? Who knows if we'll see the 2014 Python Hunt or if this was going to be a one shoot?
I say we invite all those people in Colorado.
Come on down. So there we go. That was our weird digest. You can now eat roadkill in Montana and, you know, who knows if you can get ready for 2014, when the Python Hunt commences again, and you too can pay $25 to starve in the Everglades.
Gentlemen, and by gentlemen, I just mean you and me. Ready to do some picks?
Let's pick it up. Andrew, you want to start?
I will go with a start, and I'm going to keep it quick. My pick is I watched a between Netflix Instant Streaming and Amazon Prime, there's a lot of good selection of movies there. I went and I watched the Star Trek films, all 1 through 6 in order, back. I hadn't seen them in a while. Getting ready for Star Trek Into Darkness.
They're all on there on one or the other? They're all
on
Netflix.
One or the other. Yeah. I think that Amazon, I think, has more of them. So anyhow, I went to go watch those. And, you know, you become very aware of, you know, the flaws of the odd-numbered films. And you pick up new things of where things go awry, story-wise, et cetera, and all that. But, you know, you try to pick up certain things there. You know, Star Trek 1 motion picture is a 40-minute film stretched into 2 hours. 2, Wrath of Khan, just a great film. Just a great, great film. Just classic kind of idea of just, you know, it's a sea hunt. 3 is the strongest of the odd-numbered ones. You know, it's a great bridge between 2 and 4. It's not a bad film, technically, like 1 was, or 5, which is just the worst Star Trek film. Probably one of the worst films ever. 4 is fun. 4 is where they come back to Earth. It actually was sci-fi and comedy because there were so many funny moments in there. And that was directed by Leonard Nimoy. And I think he directed 3, too. But in any event, 5 is just – that was just – yeah, 5 was just, you know, and that 5 was when people were saying this franchise is over, it's done. 5 was so bad, it was not released. You know, like 3 didn't do well overseas. So when they released Star Trek 4 and all the issues, all the things in 3 connected to it, they actually had like a 6-minute prologue that went in front of Star Trek 4, The Voyage Home, so people would know what the hell happened in other countries. Star Trek 5, like, didn't even get released internationally.
Jesus.
It was that bad. But 6 was a great movie. Nicholas Meyers, the guy that directed Wrath of Khan, came back, and Nicholas Meyers had actually written a pretty successful Sherlock Holmes story and decided to tell that kind of thing against the backdrop of an intergalactic intrigue. And 6 was just a good, great Star Trek film, good one, and that was kind of the send-off for all of the whole crew before we got the transition into the Generations movies, which just, other than First Contact, just never were that good.
I was going to say, I noticed that you said you watched all the Star Trek films, 1 through 6.
Yes. First Contact was, I'm trying to work up like to sit through Star Trek Generations, but that was just, the problem was at that point, in my opinion, is that the people who ran the TV franchise after you know, the ones that inherited Generation and other stuff basically kind of took over the film franchise too. And things that may have worked for that audience in the TV world did not work on the big screen for the most part. And that was a point when Star Trek was just lost to me. I just, you know, I tune into it and the made up techno babble, which had absolutely no bearing on anything scientific, and it always was sort of tenuous at best, but just got into so much, you know, and the plot lines were just so inherently just, I'm like, they hate the audience. But, you know, there were some great writers there, people like Ronald Moore who came from there and went on to do Battlestar Galactica, which I was skeptical of and did a great job. But anyhow, Star Trek VI.
There we go. Star Trek. All right. So you're just saying Star Trek VI. Star Trek VI is your pick?
I think all of them, but if you want to go see one, go watch Star Trek VI. And it's a great point to sort of say, okay, where do the characters in the revamped Star Trek end up?
Yeah.
You know, and then of course it's going to be different now because the whole, you know, the whole universe, the alternate timeline. But reading the Star Trek unofficial wiki, the Memory Alpha, and how they have to sort of deal with the alternate universe Star Trek. Well, technically this is, you know, the Abrams movies now are, but
yeah,
that's my pick.
All right. I'm going to pick something that I believe is, if it hasn't been picked by both you and Brian, then I know it has been picked by you, Andrew. House of Cards. It is on Netflix. It is a Netflix original production. The only thing that I can say for the show itself that I would like to see done much better is Netflix's logo at the beginning and after of the shows. Come on, spending $100 million on this, get a nice little logo thing. HBO's got the TV thing, the, you know, it's got it, just do me a favor, put a little money into that, it'll be nice. Other than that, it's fantastic. It is television at its best. You know, you have what you there's a great book right now that's out. I read it on ebook, but I think it's out in physical book as well, called The Revolution Was Televised. And it takes you through really the birth of the modern golden age of television that sort of starts with Oz and The Sopranos. But you, in that book, they go through what makes these shows fantastic. And among them are a really, really strong author, you know, a singular mind to sort of tell the story that is aided by other, you know, very, very talented writers, and just an absolute monster of a lead actor or actress. And this has both of them. It really is this amazing, super compelling story. And it's Kevin Spacey doing the best work Kevin Spacey's done in years. You know, not that he has anything to prove, because he's done so much good work in the past, but I can't remember him doing anything as good as he has with this. Now, it's been talked about a lot, but I still have, you know, this lingering idea that if these episodes were being scattered out week on week, and I understand why Netflix is doing it, I understand the point they're making, I understand that this is Netflix, it's not television, stop comparing it to television. But if I can compare it to television for 5 seconds, there are moments that I'm watching that I think would be among the most talked about moments, you know, in pop culture, would they have been released 1 week at a time, that if there was a collection of people that were all on the same page with this story. And I will just say, because I just watched it, I'm going to try to be as light spoilers as possible. There's a conversation that Kevin Spacey has with an old friend in a library. That conversation, I think, would have been a cultural kind of touchstone of discussion of fans of the show, you know, what that, you know, what that means or says about things that, you know, I think just isn't there when everybody's watching it at their own pace. Now, is giving up that, you know, just the sacrifice that you make for giving people the good experience of being able to marathon through this, you know, in one day or in, you know, however long they'd like to do it? I think that's what Netflix would say, you know, that they're fine to give up that trade for what they can offer people as subscribers. But I think there is a value to that. There's a value to being the most talked about thing on television.
All right. I'm going to, you know, until you offered up that specific example, and I know what you're talking about, I kind of just heard your arguments before. It's just kind of whining, you know?
Yes.
But having provided me with this salient, because understand, as you were speaking, I was pulling up some data to run by you, by the way.
Yes.
To sort of make the case for Netflix. But I certainly think you made a very, very good point there, which to consider. And I think, yes, I think that when we get it in these hour doses spread out over a week, it gives the TV critic something to talk about.
Yes.
You know, to do a whole next day, this is what happened kind of thing. And then that creates these sort of, oh, yeah, that was interesting. And it creates the water cooler talk. Anytime you go into television, you go pitch television or whatever, you talk to executives, they love what they call the water cooler show. And the water cooler show is that they want a show that you can only spend so much money to get people to watch. People watch a show because your friends say, you need to see this. And that happens at work at the water cooler. Oh, did you see this? No, I didn't see this. And the mindset is that when somebody hears that, they're going to go home that night or next week, be sure to watch. So next time at the water cooler, they can say, hey, and the water cooler is, of course, figurative. But anyhow, that is certainly, they certainly missed out on creating, either what, 13 episodes? 13 opportunities for water cooler talk spread out over 13 weeks. I will say that when you look at Google Trends and you compare how House of Cards performed versus you take a show like any show on broadcast television, let's say The Good Wife or The Mentalist, which are both reasonably popular shows, you know, they have a certain level of talk with a little bit of spiking, but not a lot. House of Cards out of nowhere just eclipses them.
Yeah.
And so more people were talking about House of Cards in the last, I don't know, let me see if it was 90 days, than talked about what was on broadcast television, you know, using some of those shows as an example. Now,
And I would say the thing that I was drawing comparisons to is because it debuted the same week was FX's The Americans, which was a very buzzed about show. It stars Kerry Russell and from Felicity. Is about, you know, it was well received, well critically received, but I think House of Cards has certainly eclipsed it in terms of influence. And I haven't really watched The Americans, but I would assume, you know, that it is probably a better show than The Americans, but I don't know because I don't know, you know.
And an example that I like to use too is that when we talk about Mad Men, you know, Mad Men is one of these. The Mad Men's the new Sopranos. Mad Men is this critical darling, this much beloved show. You would not know it from the way people talk about it, but it's not a very watched show compared to other programs.
Yeah.
It is reality programming on things, as I mentioned before, Duck Dynasty way outperformed Mad Men. You know, 2.5 Men in reruns outperforms Mad Men. And so as loved as this show is by fans and by critics, this is a show that all that love cannot bring it a major audience. Yeah, and it's a show that's probably a loss leader for AMC, whereas the monster now, the giant beast of cable is Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Which just, you know, is breaking records even for broadcast television and has just got everybody rethinking television content in general. And, you know, that's a show that for you and me, kind of our interest sort of waned. I know mine waned last season, but it certainly.
And if anybody who is, I've had a few people ask me, when are the recaps coming for the new episodes? Because I've done recaps up until this break. I don't know if I can do it. I don't like complaining about television. I like loving television, and I can't do it. It's not in me to just beat on this show, you know, every week. I don't want to be fake. Because I've seen websites that are not Walking Dead fans that are now doing Walking Dead recaps and are just, you know, walking through it, you know, like, cause they know it's going to draw page views and I don't want to do that. I don't want to fake it.
Let me ask you a question. This is the thing I think about a lot. And this is a great example. I don't fault somebody else for liking something. You know, Two and a Half Men is not me. You know, and I, you know, Family Guy. I'm not a Family Guy guy. Yeah. You know, and I would, people ask me like Family Guy. I go like, no, I like comedy, and and I mean, it's kind of a snarky thing, but I don't have a problem with somebody who likes something different than me. I accept that. I'm not a guy that, you know, when, you know, people are talking about the Super Bowl, you know, I'm bitching about the fact that people are talking about the Super Bowl. It's a
what
Super Bowl.
What are these sports ball things?
Exactly. I like the fact that people like, and actually I like the Super Bowl. I mean, I see that when people get upset when everybody else is into something, celebrate the fact that other things make other people happy. Otherwise, the world would be really boring and you wouldn't find new things. But in any event, Walking Dead is this monster success of a show. And, you know, it blew up last year when my patience was just tested to the ultimate point and I just gave up. And this is a show that I love the fact that I go to China and I have a conversation there with girls in Shanghai about Walking Dead because they watch it there. And it's this universal thing. And I love the fact that it has
epic humble brag just now. Epic humble brag.
Yes. So my question to you is this, okay? Is our bias, is our frustration from it, you know, because we're guys that spend a lot of time talking about story points, we're guys that pay a lot of attention to the tropes of television.
Yeah.
Has that in some ways ruined the experience of this show for us? Because, you know, we've talked about, you know, the sophomore year of any show, particularly genre shows, is always problematic because there's going to be pacing issues.
Yeah.
You're struggling to get your show to succeed that first year. So you throw everything into it you can. You create a lot of dramatic moments, a lot of upheaval. Then you get renewed for that second season. You know you've got a free ride the first few episodes. So you'll do your first episode thing, whatever, to set up, to stake the games. And then you spend six goddamn episodes doing nothing.
Yeah.
Because you're like, whoa, we don't want to have to kill ourselves like we did first season. And then you realize, oh, no, we got to do it. Now we got to pick it up. And then, you know, the end of the second season generally kind of, you know, picks
it
up.
If it is going to pick up, it picks up then.
Yeah. And then you kind of get into this, you know, third season, like, we think we figured it out. And then generally they can sometimes, but anyhow, point is, there are a lot of these little patterns that happen. A lot of these things that get set up. Is that the problem that you and I have dissected these things so much? He's like, I saw that, and I saw, man, it's the sophomore problem. You know, it's a sophomore problem with the show, and it's also this, I know this will not end well, because I know the problems I'm seeing here mean that, you know, season 5 and 6, if I can't stay through here, 5 and 6, I'm going to have to be so devoted to the characters, which I wasn't.
Well, you know, yes. I mean, the answer to that is yes, because I think what me and you wanted out of The Walking Dead was something different than it really wanted to deliver. Or at least, you know, certainly past Darabont's involvement in it, you know, because there were things that I think that were there in the first season that weren't there in the second season. But yeah, it didn't want to be a show. It was not a show whose priority was moving genre stuff story-wise forward, of going beyond the tropes. It wanted to live within them. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, obviously a ton of people, way more people, you know, want to view that, or people are okay with viewing that, and they love viewing it and they want to come back. And there's the element of what would I do in the zombie apocalypse that these characters have connected and resonate with a ton of people. It's not what I want to watch, but I certainly think that's my expectations were not what they wanted to deliver on that. Whereas I think a show like, let's say, Game of Thrones, another thing that came from very celebrated source material within its own community that now has to make the change for television. Game of Thrones does not get enough credit, which is why the but in the source material argument gets my goat so much, because nobody looks at Game of Thrones and says, I mean, here, fits and starts, but in the books, it does this, that, and the other. A certain community has that bitching. But by and large, they make a ton of changes to the storyline from the books for the show. But the additions are good. We like the final product. Whereas in Walking Dead, you see a lot of bitching about it because people assume that if they did the literal translation to the books, it would be better on television, which I don't fundamentally think is true. They've just made decisions that we don't like.
Oh, you remember, you know, when you gave me the the trade paperback to read on that. You know, my reaction to just the comic book was,
yeah,
I just didn't, I don't criticize the success of it one bit, but I just, oh man, it's just these people standing around arguing when bad stuff is happening and pushing off conflicts for as long as possible until they fall into them. I just said, I can't, this is not for me.
Yeah.
First season of the TV show, Doug, first season, you know, I'm like, ah, I'm digging this show. And it was just, for me, it was corrected all the problems I had with pacing and conflict in this one, in the comic. But then the second season, I'm like, ah, I'm like, now it's dry.
And, you know, we are right now watching the fruits of a show that, you know, there were apparently conflicts between the network and the current showrunner who replaced the old showrunner. Everybody keep up. Please keep notes that we are now heading toward our third showrunner because the creative decisions made apparently about the end of this season and the beginning of the next season ran the showrunner off that replaced the old showrunner that got run off because of the decision, the arguments with the network. So, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's, you know, I don't know how we quite got to this point in the conversation, but I totally agree with you that it's not a show that, you know, was for me anymore. And that,
yeah, I'm very happy that it's successful though. Successful show. And I don't, you know, I'm not, again, you know, the worst person in the world is something who it's not their taste and then roots for something to fail. And I just hate that. I'm very happy that it's successful because I think that overall the success of Walking Dead is good for other kinds of genre television. You know, I don't need another,
including if we are to circle back, the Netflix original series Hemlock Grove, which is another of their original series that's going to be a horror genre kind of story that I'm sure Walking Dead success did no small part in helping that get greenlit and produced. And that is executive produced by Eli Roth, I believe, stars Famke Janssen.
Yeah, I hope that does well, but I just, you know, to me, it just looks like The Killing with a werewolf.
I'll tell you what, you could say worse log lines to get me interested.
Yeah. No, I hope, well, I'm one of these people, like, I very much, I like epics or I like procedurals. You know, I like procedurals where I know that each episode, this is about this. This is what happens. I like epics where it's like, there is a grand story, the beginning, middle, and end, and we're going to put you here, and this is going to happen. Battlestar Galactica was an epic.
Yeah.
You know, the last episode drove me nuts, you know, because, you know, the last episode when, hey, we're going to use a plot line from one of these, you know, which actually the plot line was actually from I would argue, and I haven't heard this said before, but it was actually from one of the unpublished scripts from the Star Trek attempted relaunch in the 1970s for Star Trek Phase 2. But I'll put that aside. you know, that was, I love Battlestar Galactica because it was this, there's a war and there's this beginning, middle, end. Game of Thrones, you know, we're still figuring out, you know, the machinations. The books haven't even finished writing yet, but I'm enjoying this sort of, that epic sort of nature of it. And procedural shows where I know each episode, it's about X, Y, and Z. This is the plot. This is what happens. The shows that try to touch on these bigger things. And I think I go back to, like, you know, Twin Peaks. You know, Twin Peaks was, I think, one of the first, we're going to pull you more into how weird this is than the actual plot, because if you try to figure this plot out, you're just going to go nuts.
Yeah.
But it still was unsatisfying in a way when you got to the end of Twin Peaks.
Well, and it is the patron saint of how not to pace your television show, you know, that no matter if you have the full creative energy of maybe one of the most, you know, engrossingly creative minds in the history of modern, you know, in that case, television or cinema, David Lynch, you know, at his peak, even then, if you pace it like this, the fan base will turn against you and you will die. You will die in flames.
But in Lynch's defense, he was not a guy ever known for necessarily closure to stories.
No.
So the idea of having
it, you know.
So that's kind of like my question too, is the idea that when you, you know, and for a procedural show, for those of you, that's a show, let's say like CSI or Law and Order or whatever. It's a show where, you know, there's a conflict and it's resolved by the end of the episode. The characters, their job is to resolve that conflict. And I would say shows that have succeeded pretty well so far are, let's say, Dexter.
Yeah.
Okay. Dexter has these mini conflicts. There's a big conflict in each season, you know, based originally in the book. Now, whatever they create, there's a big conflict throughout the season, which at the end of the season, you want to see him kind of move on to the next step or whatever, but you don't want to see him get caught. You want to see him get the bad guys and that he's pursuing. You want to see him avoid getting into trouble, which is what makes Dexter interesting.
Yeah.
Breaking Bad, you know, has this sort of larger point that Vince Gilligan has talked about, you know, the idea that this show ends when Walter becomes just a really bad person and, you know, whatever end he's going to meet. So I'd say like, okay, we understand where that is. Some of these other shows though, it's harder for me to get into, like, you know, Last Resort, which got canceled, which is this premise of these, you know, the Navy nuclear submarine decides, you know, for some convoluted reason, whatever, they're going to threaten the world with nuclear annihilation and go start their own island kind of thing or whatever. And it's like, where does this go? You know?
Yeah.
You know, how does this end? You know, what is a season 3 episode 12 going to be? You know, like, we ran out of baked beans, you know?
And also, I mean, I'll tell you, talk about shows where you can kind of see the end and it affects the beginning is like the Hannibal relaunch, where it's like, you know, here's Will Graham dealing with, you know, the person who's going to be helping him solve these crimes is Hannibal Lecter, when it's like, you know, we kind of know where this is going, right? You know?
Yeah, I would say that I haven't seen, but if it's a procedural though, if it's based upon the idea each episode, how do they get the bad guy, or over a couple of episodes, how do they get the bad guy? You don't want to see that end happen. You want that, if that is more interesting than the idea of knowing where it ends up, you're fine with it. If the arc is going to be, you know, this long protracted, the realization that Hannibal Lecter's the bad guy, yeah, then it's going to be like, all right, Will Graham, when are you going to wake up and see this? But if it's more about the procedural aspect of it, it can be different. I'm saying that's...
Yeah, I guess, I mean, that's, we've only seen the first trailer for that hit today that I watched. And you know, to see that, you know, the trailer kind of ends with like, oh, well, there's somebody here to help you, like... Oh, my name is Hannibal, like Mr. Lecter. Like, it's like, well, then this is about Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, I didn't even see the trailer. I just reading about that. And again, there could be any number of ways, you know, now, television is
like A&E's reboot, or they're now doing a Bates, a Psycho prequel kind of, that will feature, you know, the mom who, spoiler alert, plays a big role in Psycho. I don't know if we can issue spoilers for Psycho, but it is the mom and a young Norman Bates. Like, you can get a lot out of that, because I'll tell you what, you know, you look at Norman Bates when we meet him in the movie Psycho, you got to assume there's a lot of, you know, you can do a lot in that journey before he gets to where we meet him. You know, you can see a lot of, you know, television plot lines kind of coming out of that.
You know, what's going to be interesting, and the challenge of those shows is going to be that I can't off the top of my head think of one where a major reoccurring character was an out-and-out villain, not an anti-hero, but a straight-up villain. And so when in the Hannibal show, Hannibal's a bad guy.
Yeah.
Hannibal is a bad guy. Hannibal is a guy, you knock on his door in the middle of him making tea, he will murder you.
Yes.
He kills innocents. Norman Bates killed innocents. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how those shows deal with the idea that you want them to get caught. Whereas Dexter, you don't want him to get caught.
No.
Breaking Bad, you know, up to a certain point, you can kind of justify Walter White's behavior in certain ways, but then there's a point where you can no longer justify it in a sense, but there are other characters you kind of root for. It's going to be interesting where the named characters, the principal characters, are unredeemable, you know, are pure evil. Because how do you want this to go on 5 or 6 seasons?
True, you know, and you know, there are different ways that you can kind of get into that story. But I think you're right that, you know, there is a difference between fascinating if I could coin a term, root forable.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. We are super long here on this episode, so let's wrap it up. And hopefully next time.
I fell asleep a long time ago.
I know. Hopefully next time we'll have Brian.
Yeah. We'll remember to tell.
Nope.
Kidding. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. It's been weird.
You want to sponsor the podcast? Do you have $30? If so, go to weirdthings.com/sponsor and you can have Justin say whatever you want. He's a trained ape.